what is life without those things? Right? There's no productivity from dancing. Maybe it gives you some exercise, right? But you do that because it sparks within your soul something that says, yes, I'm alive. I'm more than just a job or what I do. I get to be, and that's enough. Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Jenny Wang. I'm a clinical psychologist, speaker, and author. I'm based here in Houston, Texas, and I have a clinical practice as well as speak corporately and also offer trainings and workshops surrounding mental health, especially within children of immigrants and Asian diaspora.
Dr. Wang, welcome to Money Bites.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Me too. This has been on top of my mind for quite a while, to the point where it's actually been impacting my productivity at work. Mm-hmm. So very apropos, the context that I'd love to discuss today is there has been quite a bit of bloodshed to the tune of almost, I think, 200K folks have been laid off in 2023. Mm-hmm. And the uncertainty of all of that is obviously having a lot of impact on a lot of folks. So would love to spend this session with your expertise on how do we manage uncertainty, and also how do we, in a helpful way, deal with what a job should mean to us?
That's a great question.
So let me start off with the uncertainty part. In the age of uncertainty, what's a gauge to assess, am I dealing with this in a healthy way or I should go seek help?
I think that with the idea of uncertainty, we have to realize that we're mostly operating under the illusion of certainty for most of our lives, right? Just like the illusion of control. We think that, oh yeah, I can generally predict how my day today will go. I can generally predict perhaps my health, right, for this next week. The reality is none of us know with certainty what's around the corner, right? But we operate as if things will stay the course, right? And that's why I think when things change quickly, we often are blindsided because we almost try to ignore the possibility of uncertainty in our everyday lives as a form of psychological protection, right? Because if we don't learn to tolerate the emotional discomfort that uncertainty brings up, our nervous systems get really dysregulated because we're like, oh my gosh, nothing feels stable. How am I supposed to navigate this world where anything could happen at all times? So to manage that discomfort, we say, oh no, but I'm certain about my life. I'm pretty certain that these things will happen, that I'll have a job, that I'll, you know, be with this partner, all of that. And so we close that kind of space in which we're actually open about what's to come, for better or for worse. And so I think one of the things that I try to help my clients do is like, can we learn and practice how to sit with uncertainty? So this might be too TMI, but I'm going to share anyway. I recently had like my first mammogram because I'm getting to that age. And I remember sitting there and laying there, and I had done the ultrasound, and she was like, I'm going to step outside and talk to the radiologist and see if there's anything else we need to check. So I'm laying there and I'm feeling the uncertainty, right? I don't know what they're going to say because they never tell you anything as they're scanning you. They just have this serious face and they're clicking and they're like measuring. And in that space, I had to sit with the discomfort of one, the possibility that things looked fine, come back in a year. Or the possibility that she could come back and tell me there's something bad here. And your life may fundamentally change in this moment. And I remember feeling the mounting anxiety and thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I don't know that I can tolerate this. Right. And I could feel my heart rate going up and I could feel my body like starting to tense. And as that was happening, I had to literally coach and talk to myself through that moment and say, you can either allow your mind to go down that rabbit hole of uncertainty and fear and anxiety and literally create suffering for yourself in these next 10 minutes that you're waiting, or you can live in this present moment where right now you are healthy as far as you know. Right now, there's no bad news yet. Right now, you are breathing and moving and living. And as I was able to remind myself, not of the what if, but of the what is, I was able to notice my body calming down. And I was able to sit and wait, right, until that woman returned. And that was only 10 minutes, right? But right now, a lot of people, right, are sitting with uncertainty for days, for weeks, for months. And I think that in our current kind of modern world, we don't get many opportunities to practice sitting with uncertainty or even the feeling of waiting for something anymore. Right? Like, oh, I'm hungry. I'm going to Uber Eat something and I know exactly when it's going to come. Or I need groceries. I'm going to order it and I know it's going to get here by 1 p.m. Everything about our lives now is measured and metriced down to the minute. We don't really sit in this waiting or open-endedness anymore. And so your question was, how do I know when I've moved from managing it well to, ooh, I might need help? And I think our ability to sit with the uncertainty or some of the anxiety that the unexpectedness of life, right? When I can sit with it, but it doesn't cause me to freeze. It doesn't cause me to shut down. I'm able to sit with it, notice it, realize it's there, wonder to myself, is there any tangible action I can take in the midst of the uncertainty? And if not, realize it's outside of my control or responsibility and move on, right? Direct the focus of my attention to things I can control. And if that's your process, then I would say you're handling it pretty well, right? But if I feel the uncertainty, I freeze or tense up, I start to spiral in my thoughts, right? I start to dig into these fear-based catastrophic rabbit holes, and I cannot mobilize to think clearly towards tangible action or to think clearly towards accepting this is my reality and moving on, then I would say maybe it's time to get some help, right? Because we know that inaction or freeze response, right, is one of our stress responses as human beings. And if we live in that mode too long, it becomes problematic, right? Well, then we're not engaging in healthful behaviors. We're not moving our body. We're not social. We're isolated. We're shut down. And that becomes a problem for our mental health. So I would say that the freeze response initially is natural, right? Like the, oh my gosh, I'm kind of scared and I don't know what's coming. But then if you're able to move through that freeze response to gain action and momentum again, then I think you're processing and metabolizing that uncertainty. Okay. But if you're freezing and then it's triggering panic and anxiety and maybe even depression and isolation, then I would say, ooh, okay, maybe it's time to get some help and support.
I love the almost meditativeness of how you're addressing this. One thing that I am experiencing right now is my reaction to it hasn't necessarily been a moment of panic or anxiety, but it's been almost me getting distracted or me actively distracting myself and kind of making me feel numb. Few questions there. One, is numbness also a potential sign of, I don't want to say like wrong way of dealing with uncertainty, but like a way of dealing, coping with uncertainty? And then the second part would be like, before you reach out to a professional for support, is there anything that we could try to internally and self do to kick yourself into gear of, hey, you're spiraling, let's take a pause?
Yeah. So the numbing response or the almost dissociative response, right? The I'm going to utilize something to distract from the negative emotion that uncertainty brings up, that is falls within the same area or category as a freeze response. Right? Or it's a flee. So for stress responses in human beings, we've only evolved a couple coping mechanisms. So fight, flight, freeze, and then feigning, fawning are these kind of like secondary or other responses in terms of long-term stress. But flight, right? Fight, flight, freeze are the kind of most common ones. And so in some ways, the numbing is that freeze. And then the distraction or dissociation kind of is I'm going to flee from it. I'm going to disengage. I'm going to try to run away, right? Psychologically from it. And so some people will engage in like binge watching shows to not think about it, right? Or they'll dissociate through video games or perhaps like alcohol, things like that to kind of say, okay, I don't want to feel this. And so I'm going to use whatever I can to distance and dissociate from it. You know, I say like coping mechanisms are coping mechanisms, right? Some are more healthful and some are more problematic. And it is natural when we're overwhelmed, especially for a prolonged period of time, to go into a numbing response because the mind cannot handle a constant stimulation, constant stress response. You know, it's kind of like, if you like rub at your kind of like a spot for so long that after a while your brain is just like shut off because it cannot sustain that stimulus and the pain and the input, right? And so similarly, the mind numbs because it says, I've hit capacity of the stimulus that I can process and understand. And so in order to protect itself, it numbs itself. And the thing with that is in a short term, it might be necessary because you can't escape that situation right now. But in the long term, what it does is it actually cuts you off from the necessary information and inputs that help inform what action needs to come next, right? To take you out of that situation. And so, you know, in psychology, there's this kind of term of like learned helplessness, right? Where the classic psychology experiment, these dogs, unfortunately, were shocked over and over, and they were not given an opportunity to escape. And at first they would try to claw their way out. They would bark, they would whimper, they would do everything as like, I'm going to fight this. And once they realized they could not escape over a prolonged long period of time, they gave up. They laid down. They just sat in the cage and let themselves be shocked, because there was a sense of, I cannot get out of this, right? And that's the numbing. That's the, I no longer can mobilize action because it's too much. And so that numbing response, right, if we can't move out of it, also creates that dissociation or avoidance where we get stuck then in life situations and we feel like we're repeating it over and over again and we can't see a way out, right? And many of us have been in that situation in all different contexts before. And so often in those moments, that's when we need other outside people, friends, family, mental health professional to be like, hold on, you're stuck in a loop. You might be replaying the same dynamics, replaying the same perhaps problematic behaviors over and over that are keeping you trapped. And we can't see the escape hatch because we've become so kind of numbed. We've become so dissociated from it, right? And so I think that's when we need to then have people who are like calling us and saying, hey, are you okay? I haven't seen you in weeks. Mm-hmm. Or, hey, I've noticed a change in you, right? Are you okay? What's going on? How can I be there? Is one of the things that calms and regulates our nervous system is social connection, right? That's why that's one of the pillars of mental health, is being connected with other people regrounds us, stabilizes us, and calms that overregulated nervous system enough so that we can actually do something to change our lives. You had a second question and I've forgotten it because I've been talking on and on.
Before we go on to the second question, I actually want to come back to what you just said for totally understand, like, we being social creatures, we should sort of give and take and depend on each other. But are there things that we could do ourselves that aren't necessarily sort of a damsel in distress?
Explain more what you mean about damsel in distress. That feels like a storyline.
I am wondering if I am stuck in this mental state and I need to lean on somebody else to check in on me for me to get the power to break out of it. It feels like I need to wait until my social network is able to notice and sort of lend a hand.
Yeah. So I think as social beings, that's one facet of kind of being able to step out of this. But if you've done some internal work, if you perhaps have read books, done some introspection, your own therapy, perhaps, one of the biggest things we teach our clients is, how do you stay attuned to your internal life enough that you know when you start to go off track? And so the other facet is the individual sense of miscalibration and when it happens, right? So people will say, when I feel off, either I'm feeling depressed or I'm really anxious or I'm just not feeling well in terms of my mental health, I notice these things. And we start to build out that list, right? They'll say, I sleep a lot more, I binge watch things more, maybe I overeat. I start to notice that I'm isolating. I don't want to go out and dance, even though I love to dance. All of those things are those yellow and red flags that are telling you, you are not in your typical state, right, of thriving, if you want to call it that, right? And there are going to be seasons where you move in and out of thriving. So I don't want to create the sense that we should always feel like we're thriving. That's not realistic, right? But you know what it feels like to feel empowered, courageous, motivated, engaged with your life. And you also probably know what it feels like when you feel the opposite of all those things. And that's what I would call like misalignment, right? Something feels off kilter in your life due to whatever cause, or sometimes not even a cause, it just happens. And so one of the things that we can do, right, is can we start to build out in our mind that mental spectrum of when we feel like we're in the zone of thriving, or what I say, kind of the green zone. And then when would you start to say, oh, I'm in the yellow, and oh, I'm approaching the red zone, which is the zones that I feel disempowered, I feel scared, I feel anxious, right? And as a person develops that spectrum for themselves as a key tool for their mental health wellness, now when I say to them, where are you in that scale? They have a pretty good sense. And when I can identify where I am in that scale, then we've now buttressed that with a list or a toolkit of things that they can do to tweak and micro adjust and move them out of that zone, right? So let's say they're maybe in the yellow zone for a few weeks. And that means they're eating poorly, they're not going to the gym as much, they're not seeing friends, they're not taking time to rest. Then that's when those tools come into play to help them start to micro adjust so that they can feel more regulated again and move back into the green. But let's say they've pushed themselves, maybe work is really intense and they haven't had time to take care of their mental health and their physical health. And they've pushed until they're in the red. And for some people that looks like burnout, apathy, right? I'm done. I want to quit my job every day. Then there's those list of tools, right, within that zone that helps them start to move back, right? The thing is, I always say that most of my clients know what they can be doing to improve their mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us just don't do it because we have excuses like, I don't have the time, I don't have the energy, I don't have the resources. Many of these things are free, first of all. Many of them take maybe 10, 15, 20 minutes, right? But what are we doing instead? We're dissociating. We're watching our shows, right? We're on our phone scrolling for an hour instead of moving our bodies, right? So I absolutely think that we have the ability to course correct, right? But many of us haven't practiced those muscles well enough so that when we are starting to feel poorly, we can't micro adjust. We just keep going deeper into the red zone.
Are the tools that you mentioned different from willpower, or is willpower needed in that yellow and red zone to buoy yourself to implement the tools?
So I'm a believer that our society overestimates the importance of willpower and underestimates the power of consistency. Because if it is down to a matter of willpower, I will always at some point feel deficient because I don't actually want to do some of these things most of the time, right? So it's like, oh, it's just that I'm lacking willpower. And that's an identity thing, right? It's like I don't have enough willpower and therefore my mental health is failing. That feels kind of shaming. It feels kind of like stigmatizing, right? And in my mind, I'm more kind of like, whether or not you have the willpower or not, can we actually just create systems or rituals for yourself that you can commit to for yourself? And we want to make them as tangible and as easy as possible. And sometimes it's as small as like, when you finish work today, I'm going to promise to myself that I'm going to go for a 10-minute walk in the sun, right? Because I have been in a closed room all day, right? Yeah. And sometimes it's as small as that, where I'm kind of like, you have 10 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. And in that instance, it's not about a willpower issue, right? It's a, can I just put my shoes by the door right outside of my office? Because then when I come out, I'm cued for the behavior. I'm primed to do it. Or can I be wearing my workout clothes with like a coat over it while I'm working? And so when I'm done, I take off my jacket and I go for my walk, right? And I think James Clear with that book, Atomic Habits, talks a lot about those cues and creating the environment to support the actions that we're moving towards so that it's no longer a willpower issue, right? It's more about a commitment to just doing one small thing. And that then builds to a bigger thing or a longer thing over time.
I love this. So at Winnie, one of the things that we do with budgeting is rather than spending your money and at the end of the month trying to figure out, all right, how am I going to piecemeal savings towards my goals? We encourage our users to create their own pay yourself first bucket and systemize savings before you start spending the money. So take those money out towards your, you know, retirement, down payment, travel savings buckets, and then spend the rest. So I love the symmetry of create a system for yourself, habitualize it, so that you don't need to have the willpower or the energy when you don't have the energy to go on a walk.
Right. Yes. And just like how in your model, you protect the money that is for an intentional use or purpose first. And then you see what you have left. Mental health is the same. You block that time for your walk on your schedule before it even comes, right? You protect those behaviors and systems that you put in place because you know that the higher value is your mental health, which if you don't have, nothing else matters, right? Yeah. And so it's the prioritization of that habit or behavior at the front end and allowing what's left, right, to then be filled in by less priority things. But I think a lot of us, we do it the opposite. We say, oh, work goes first, and then we schedule ourselves around it, right?
I want to double click into this and also pull in what you mentioned about thriving. When we reflect on ourselves in best self, like our thriving self, where does work in job and career fit into this?
So I feel like we could talk about this for like the next, part 5 hours, right? Yeah. But I think first of all, we all need to clarify the relationship that we have with work, right? Because it isn't the same across all types of people. For some people, work is about purpose, passion, mission, right? An impact that they're having in this world. For others, it's a source of stability that frees them up, right? To then do other things in their life, right? That they really love and care about. For others, it's about kind of achievement, fame, right? Like financial accolade, all of those things. It feeds a part of their identity and that's what drives them, right? So there are many facets to what work means. And so I think the first question is, what does your work mean to you? You know, and I think we talked about this in our kind of pre-call that like some generations think that passion and work as Venn diagrams, they need to intersect in order for work to be meaningful to them. Whereas I think about our parents' generation, it's like, they don't have to intersect at all because work was providing for a family and stability. And that was enough, right? Didn't matter that they necessarily hated their job or didn't like their colleagues. They were willing to tolerate it for that purpose. And so I think once you clarify what work is for you and what it feeds in terms of our internal needs, then I think we can talk about kind of, you know, how that plays into a greater picture of like how we prioritize our time and things like that, you know? And also this idea of thriving. I think as human beings, and not everybody will agree with me, but I think that work when it is in contrast to balanced moments of play and rest, work can sometimes be something that we're excited to return back to. If it is a job that we generally enjoy, we like our colleagues, you know, we feel motivated for. And so like you have people where like they maybe retire early and then they're just kind of like, my life feels like I don't have purpose. I feel aimless, right? There's a reason why, you know, people when they retire, they have medical issues arise, right? Things like mortality, suddenly, they suddenly go from retired to I want to travel the world to suddenly a medical emergency, right? Because there's something about work that gives us meaning and purpose, even if it is just the work of it, like showing up because you've agreed to show up today and you're being there for your colleagues and you have a commitment to yourself, right? But when that's gone and you don't have other facets of your identity to go to, people can suddenly feel aimless, right? So I think for some people, work is a part of that thriving process where they feel engaged. They feel like their mind is working in creative ways. They're solving problems. And when there is a balance, and we talk about balance, and I really don't like that word, right? But when there's, I would say, a flow, right, between work and other facets of your life, then I think most people might feel like they're thriving. But it's when work becomes maybe too much of a priority, that it overtakes family, time off, right? Hobbies, other interests, and it kind of subsumes that other parts of our lives, that some people then start to say, I'm burning out, and start to have these greater existential questions of like, why am I doing this? One of the kind of practices that kind of falls within like the Stoic philosophy, right? Stoicism is, there's a meditation on mortality, right? This idea that like, if you knew your life was going to end in 10 years or five, how would you live differently? And they kind of think about that in a practice sort of way, because then it reminds you that your time is precious. And so when you're applying your time towards things like work and family and all this other stuff, it helps you keep a sense of perspective on your life. That I think people, when they feel like they're thriving, they feel as though the things that truly matter to them are in the right place in their life. But people who are often struggling, overwhelmed, burnt out, they know that the priorities that they've set, right, do not match truly what they care about. And so they're spending the minutes and the precious time of their life focused on things that they know if their life were to end a year from now, they would regret it.
My gut reaction to this is twofold. I feel on one part, it makes me think I'm already spending so much time at my work. If I have that sense of time being precious and sort of where we started off about potential uncertainty of life, it makes me want to almost dig my heels deeper and think, okay, then my job needs to have a much bigger meaning, a much bigger, like it should enmesh with, like I should be deriving value out of it, passion out of it. Or should I be thinking more in terms of, if I only had one more year to live, would I be even in this career, in this job? Should I be reassessing? I want to buy a one-way ticket to, I don't know, some exotic land. And should it be a fundamental, should I even work kind of discussion?
Mm-hmm. And I think that is right. The reality, though, is that most of us need to work in order to live, right? And so if you're not privileged enough to be able to choose if you're going to work or not, then if you do have to work, is this the type of work that you want to be spending your precious time on, you know? And if not, are there ways to find meaning or purpose in your current job? Perhaps participating in an affinity group, a resource group committee, does that give you purpose? Or connecting with colleagues, being a mentor, right? Being a leader of some sort, because that could give you some of those elements, right? Of having meaning and purpose in your work that is independent to your tasks, right? Because that's different. Mm-hmm. I think tasks, they're going to be fun some days and not so fun other days. And that's the nature of work. But could you see an element of your work that you can carve out that feeds that need? Or do you just feel like, you know what? I don't really have close relationships in my workplace. I don't really feel necessarily valued or heard. I feel like sometimes I'm just a cog.
Mm.
And if that's the case, is it the culture of the organization you're in? Could you find a setting that is more suited to the culture that you would really want for yourself? Or could you reframe your work as being this, the financial and the stability that you can now utilize to create meaning outside of work, right? So you can be a part of organizations, nonprofits that are doing work that matter to you and that it gives you resourcing for these other facets, you know? And I'm not against people saying, I'm going to buy a one-way ticket somewhere. You know, sometimes we do discover really amazing facets of ourselves in novel settings, right? That's why vacations are so great, because you kind of see yourself in these other worlds, other lives, right? But is it one-way ticket with intention, or is it a one-way ticket as an escape, right? Those are questions that I think we need to ask ourselves, because if it were escaping and one day we still have to return back here, then have we just kicked the can further down, right? Where we don't want to make the hard decision. We don't want to have the hard conversations or confront some real realities within ourselves.
This is a question I've been grappling with for such a long time in terms of what am I working for? And I love how you're framing that it doesn't necessarily need to be a one size fit all. Work needs to equal your passion. Work needs to equal your life meaning. Although it still feels, if I'm working 10 to 12 hours a day.
It's a lot.
That's a lot of time.
Yeah. A third of your life spent at work. And I think it depends person to person, right? I think for me and how I understand myself, I think my soul would die a little bit if I didn't do something that I believed in. Mm-hmm. But that's me, right? And, you know, I was an immigrant kid. I was supposed to become a CPA. Like that was my path. But I knew that that wasn't the space that I wanted to live a third of my life in. Right. And so I think sometimes if we can honor that voice inside that says, you know what, I'd rather be out there, I don't know, baking bread and selling it at a farmer's market, right? Like I've seen people do that and leave consulting careers to start like a bread making company. And they have done amazingly well because that was their passion. And they found that when they were like 50, right? And you're just like, sometimes if you have the privilege and the resources, could you allow yourself to try some unmarked path and see where it leads you? And not everybody can do that, right? You may be supporting a family. You might have student loans. That is not always a reality for you. But then can you create a small space where that might be cultivated, right? Can you have a little supper club that you host with your friends? Can you take an art class? Can you learn a new instrument, right? There's a facet of you that longs for something. And if work's not giving it to you, that may be okay if you can create space for that other thing, right? To live in that space until you decide if that's something that you want to go all in for, right? So I don't necessarily tell people it's a good idea to drop your job and then do your side hustle, right? But if you have the privilege to explore, right? And I think so much of life as adults, we've removed this idea that life also should have areas where it's a playground, where you're testing and experimenting. For example, I'm super excited because I just booked my lesson this morning. I'm going to learn the ukulele. And like, I'm just never done it before, but my kids are going in for lessons. And I was like, why don't I sit there for a lesson then for the 30 minutes too? And I don't know if I'm going to be good at it. I may not, but it's that playground, right? And 30 minutes a week, I get to play at something that I've never done before. And I might learn and see myself in a different way.
I love that. One of the books that I really enjoyed was Designing Your Life.
Yes, it's a great one.
It's a great book. In it, they had the four life pillars. What was it? Health, career, relationships, and play.
Mm-hmm.
Play is harder than people give credit.
Yes.
120% agree with you. Like play, it's that spark of joy, but as an adult, you got to schedule it in.
Yes, you do, right? And think about all the narratives of, I don't know, in my case, eldest daughter, child of immigrants, right? Like you got to work for every single minute of your life in order to have value. And society, capitalism says that too. So many of us feel guilt if we want to play. So many of us feel guilt if we say, I'm going to do this small thing for 30 minutes for myself. Because we have all these other people that might be depending on us, right? And so slowly play becomes this thing that was like, I did that when I was 5. I did that when I was a child, right? And you ask the question, what are we working for?
Mm-hmm.
Are we not working for the ability to experience moments of joy, moments of play, moments of ease, moments of connection? What is life without those things? You think about the feeling you get when you're dancing.
Mm-hmm.
It has no other purpose but to fulfill that sense of joy, connection, play. Right? There's no productivity from dancing. Maybe it gives you some exercise, right? But you do that because it sparks within your soul something that says, yes, I'm alive. I'm more than just a job or what I do. I get to be, and that's enough.
Dr. Wong, I think you truly moved me with that last bit. Can we end on the note of how can we introduce a bit more play into our joy, into our lives for folks who haven't quite experimented with themselves in a while?
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is why I wrote a whole chapter about play in my book, because it is such an elusive idea, especially for adults, you know? And I think that like so many of us, we might have felt sparks in our childhood. Like maybe we love to paint. We love to draw. I watch my own kids, right? And I'm like, they're just naturally drawn to certain things. My daughter, she could sit all day doodling and drawing and creating cartoons. And I think to myself all the time, I hope she never loses that.
Mm.
Right? Because at one day she might be sitting in a room like this saying to herself, well, I have work to do. I have all these other important things. And so that spark starts to fizzle out, right? And so I think one of the things I always encourage people to think about is like, when was the last time you felt excited, like a childhood excitement? Like, I can't wait to do this, right? What was the thing that sparked that emotion of excitement? Because I think as adults, and I don't know about you, but for me, I don't necessarily get super excited in my day to day, right? There's no like, oh my gosh, I can't wait. Like, I'm so excited. I can't wait till this thing happens, right? That doesn't really happen. I feel like our lives are so routine. Yeah. And so what is that thing maybe from your childhood or the thing that you wish you could have done, but your parents never let you do? Right? Like, I don't know. I want to, dance, play a sport, do something where it was like your parents were like, no, that doesn't qualify as a activity that's worth investing in. What was that? Right. Because I think those longings don't die or go away. They just sit kind of stagnant, compartmentalized. And so play can look like a hobby, but play can also look like being outside, being in nature, right? It can look like laughing, right? My son loves to tell jokes, and sometimes he'll just sit and read a joke book to us, right? And we're like laughing until our bellies hurt. And that's play, right? And so play, I think, like you said earlier, I think it sometimes needs to be scheduled, especially if it's not an active part of your life right now.
Can I jump off of that? Are there activities that we default to that is not play?
Yes. So I think sometimes people will say, I watch shows. Right. That's my play time or relaxing time. And I'm like, okay, that's cool, you know, but there's a difference between dissociative rest and restorative rest. And restorative rest, I think, although I don't have the research to back it, but I think it requires more engagement in order for it to be restorative. Dissociative rest is I'm going to turn on a show and like half watch it while I'm scrolling on my phone. All of that is I'm only 50% engaged. I'm not really here. I'm not really there. I just need somewhere to park my brain. And we all need that sometimes. But at the end of it, a lot of people will say, but I don't feel any better. I don't feel any more restored. I just feel kind of like continuation of blah. Whereas restorative rest has an intentionality behind it. It is a focused attention to something. Maybe it's like one of those adult coloring books where you're just coloring with all these different colors and watching it kind of appear. But it requires a level of focused attention and engagement that then I think feeds the soul in a certain way, you know? So it might even just be meditative walking. Leave your phone at home. Go for a walk. Look up at the sky. Watch the birds. Listen, right? I think right now we live in worlds where we're so cloistered. Our stimulus is a rectangle, right? Our stimulus is a rectangle we hold. We don't have actual stimuli that meet the sensory needs that we need as human beings. And so I think restorative rest requires you to focus on it in order for it to be meaningful, in order for it to feel playful even. You can't play if you're distracted. Like my kids all the time are like, play with me, play with me. And then I'm like half like typing an email and I'm like, okay, I'm half playing, but I'm not, right? That's not play. Play is a here and now experience, right? Just like dancing. You can't half dance, right? You won't get the steps right. You won't move. You won't feel the music. And so I think play has to, in many ways, forces us to be in the moment and to be present. And that's a key element too. And so what does it look like for you to engage in something? Maybe it's baking bread. For some people, that is play. Feeling the flour across their hands, the kneading, right? The smell, the sensations of it. That can be restorative. So I think for me, play has no exterior ulterior motive. It brings us in the moment, right? And allows us to truly set aside those drives of productivity and achievement.
Seems the common theme for today is if you're spiraling out from uncertainty, come back to the present.
Yes.
And to thrive in your life, come back to the present. So live in the moment seems to be the takeaway.
Yes. And that's why mindfulness, right, is scientifically backed as something that supports our mental health, right? Not meditation necessarily, but living mindfully, being here and now. And the thing with that uncertainty is it is actually uncertainty is a focus on the future, what is to come. But guess what? You can't change or tangibly affect the future. That's impossible. All you do have control over is right now. The singular choice you make after you listen to this podcast, what are you going to do? What are you going to do in the next moment? So Viktor Frankl, who is, you know, Holocaust survivor, psychiatrist, writer, he writes about how life is simply about answering the question of the moment that life poses to you. What is the question that life is asking of you right now? And simply acting in accordance to the answer. So my question for your listeners is, what is the question that life is asking of you right now?
That's deep. love it. I this was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Of course.
Before we break, where can our winners find your book?
Yes. So you can find it at any book retailer, Amazon, Target, Barnes and Nobles. It's called Permission to Come Home, Reclaiming Mental Health as Asian Americans. And there's an audiobook version as well as the hard copy version.
Love it. Thank you so much. Super appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me. And it was such a joy to speak with you. And thank you for creating this community that I think is really helping others figure out what means like important to their life. So thank you.
Love it. Thank you.